Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. We all know that our region is rich in historical significance and importance. Names that come to mind do not always include a large number of African Americans with strong ties to this area who have contributed. We all know names like Dred Scott, Josephine Baker, and Jackie Joyner Kersee. But there are scores who remain unknown to most people, blacks included. But local educator and historian John Wright and his wife Sylvia have put together the stories of more than 100 blacks who have made an indelible mark on our history and our culture. It's titled Extraordinary Black Missourians, Pioneers, Leaders, Performers, Athletes, and Other Notables Who Have Made History. John Wright joins me in studio to talk about the book. We can make this interactive after John and I chat for a couple of moments. Give us a call and tell us what African-American notable you feel should be on his list. And let's see if he or she is. There's a challenge for you, John. nice to have you with
Same,
us.
Same. Glad to be here, Don.
Well, congratulations on the book. There are a lot of folks in here that a lot of people have never heard of who have certainly made important contributions to our culture and society.
Yeah, we kept finding individuals all the way up until the time we finished, and even after we finished. The trick is to try to get a wide diversity of individuals and personalities from around the state. You know, you keep getting asked, we keep getting asked questions about so-and-so, but they're all from St. Louis. Mm-hmm. If it's a state book, you can only include so many in one volume on St. Louis. And so it's hard selecting the number. My wife's already talking about the second volume.
I was going to say, you mentioned earlier that she was already at work on
getting that. Yeah, we're making a list already.
From what field do most of the notables in your book come from? Is there one that dominates?
I think we have a number of educators, and there are a number of sport personalities, sure, and entertainers. Mm-hmm. So I think that's the widest group. Then we have the civil rights group.
Yeah. Most people would know the entertainers. I mean, some of the names. I mean, you include Nelly, so we're coming right up to the present day.
Right.
But going back to a great many, Scott Joplin and Josephine Baker and many others as well.
But there are a number of them. I don't think people, like Blind Boone, many people don't know about him. I would say Clark Terry, they've heard of Clark, but they don't know his roots in Carondelet in St. Louis. So we have a number of individuals they've heard about, but a number of individuals they haven't.
What do you hope for this book? I mean, obviously you had in mind familiarizing everybody with these people that you've included. What is your grand design for this book?
Hopefully, we felt that we are at a time now where there are very few African-American educators in many of the districts. We have a segregated community where you have whites who don't come in contact with African-Americans, and you have African-American youngsters. We want to be able to dream of possibilities. And by being able to read stories of individuals who succeed in spite of all odds, it may inspire them to think about possibility. I think about Henry Armstrong, who was laying railroad ties, and all of a sudden the wind blew up. But this newspaper article said, get chocolate made over $700,000, so many in a brief period of time. And he threw his railroad ties, tools down, and said, I'm going to be a champion. You know, he dreamed of that.
Yeah.
We had George Washington Carver left home at 11 to go out because he had a dream. And the thing we want to have youngsters do is a dream of possibilities.
You know, you're an educator, longtime educator. Why is it, and I think this probably is an easy question to answer, but why is it that so few of the people that you've included have been excluded from the history books over the decades?
I think intentionally. We have to remember that our textbooks are chosen by large school districts. And you have many districts who don't want to put African Americans in the history books. And so it's a money issue. And if the great city schools would say, we're only going to purchase books that are integrated and inclusive, the companies would change. It's a money issue. Mm-hmm. And I think the more pressure comes upon schools to have inclusive texts, the more we'll see change happen.
You know, I thought we had not gotten completely past the point where this sort of thing was going on, but that we're pretty well past it. And you're indicating that we're not.
Racism makes money. You know, you have people who hustle housing. We have people who get elected to office. And it's like we've seen now with the politicians. They cater to a small group, and you have some who still insist on the old way of life to so they can get elected to office and make money. And when it stops being profitable, we'll see change.
You know, correct me if I'm wrong on this, and I may be on somewhat dangerous ground, but haven't I heard that so many of the textbooks in this country are printed and published in Texas, and that that's part of the deal?
Well, you have a large number of them. But like I said, the large districts that purchase the bulk of many of the textbooks determine what's in those books because of the volume of their distribution.
Yeah. The getting back to your design and desire for the book, ambitions for the book, you want them in schools.
I'd like to see them in schools. I think with our African-American youngsters, even with our white youngsters, with the African-American kids who sit down every day, and it's like being at a family reunion where you're talking about the family, but you're not included. And if you feel good about yourself, you can feel good about others. I think that's important. And you take pride. I know the book I did on the Kinloch and the Ville communities. Those people take those books. People can't keep them in their homes because people grab them and borrow them because they feel good about the hometown and her area. And I think if youngsters feel good about themselves, they have a different attitude in school.
Let me use this moment to take an opportunity to plug something we're doing on St. Louis Public Radio. We have a feature called St. Louis History in Black and White, which are condensed versions of a couple of dozen programs that we've done here focusing on civil rights issues and issues of the African-American community going all the way back to Dred Scott up through Barack Obama. And I think this is a great resource, too, for youngsters who want to learn more about the African-American experience here in St. Louis. So that's something that works very well in conjunction with your book. John Wright, who is the most important person in your book that nobody's ever heard of?
Oh, boy. Why would you ask me that? Why would you ask me that? Oh, boy, that's a challenging question that no one's heard about.
Well, you know what I mean. That is pretty obscure, although the contributions have been significant.
I would say Alvin Coffey. Now, Alvin Coffey was born in slavery. He went with his owner to California to mine gold. His owner was sick most of the time. He worked day and night mining gold for himself and his owner. His owner promised him he would get his freedom. But on the way back, he sold Coffey, took his money. Yeah. Coffey convinced his new owners to let him go back to mine gold for them and to pay for his own freedom. He went out and did that. He went back to California, set up a school. They became prosperous farmers in the area. He's the only African-American in the California pioneers. And I think it shows determination. It shows what can be done. Another one would be Charles Anderson. Yes, well, I'm going to give you two. Yeah. He was denied the ability to fly.
The aviator.
He was an aviator. Mm-hmm. He built a plane, fixed it up. He and a friend flew all the way to the West Coast using a road map without all the parachutes and all the other things. And he flew to one of the islands. He was the individual in the airplane with Eleanor Roosevelt that was a starting point for the Tuskegee Airmen.
A picture with him, with her, is in the book.
Right.
You call him the father of African-American aviation.
That's right,
that's
yes.
That's right. And I have to confess, I'd never heard of him. I wonder, you know, how many people in the black community
probably
know
haven't.
Of him.
Yeah. My wife found him in the newspaper one Sunday, and he finished from my high school, Sumner High School. He lived in University City on a farm at a time when very few blacks lived in University City, but he grew up on a farm there and went into St. Louis. He was valedictorian of his class.
Didn't he go to MIT?
He was at MIT, right? Yes.
Right. Extraordinary story.
Yes.
You know, we've already started to get some calls. I have many questions, but I don't want to discourage Ben, who's on his cell phone, from hanging up on us. He wants to get into the conversation. And again, we're inviting everyone. 382-8255 is the number. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. You can also send us a tweet at STL on air. And what we'd like to know is what African-American notables you think should be on John Wright's list. Ben, thanks for being with us. Go ahead.
Well, I'm not sure if these would apply to this state in particular. I'm ashamed to tell I don't really know enough. I think they'd be from other states, though. But I think you have a good idea about putting them in textbooks, because even in areas where of history where they're key importance, a lot of time, like the Civil War, a lot of time they get glossed over, like Harriet Tubman, Frederick Douglass. A lot of times they may get a passing mention at best, but these were still key historical figures in that area that deserve that deserve just as big as mention as Abraham or Lincoln and Stephen Douglas.
Ben,
like Harriet Tubman and Frederick Douglass.
Ben, thanks for the call. I think, John, you would agree that Harriet Tubman and Douglas have gotten quite a bit of attention.
I would agree. Our concentration was mainly in this area, St. Louis and Missouri. Because you can cover the waterfront, but we tried to narrow it down.
Yeah, and narrowed it down. It's still more than 100 people that you were talking about. You know, one of the things that I found an interesting way to start your book is with your unsung hero. And I'm not going to attempt to pronounce his name because my French is not that bon. So tell us what that's about.
Toussaint Louverture. Toussaint was the responsible for the Haitian Revolution. And many people don't realize that the French, Napoleon, had planned on building an empire in the Western Hemisphere. And all the Louisiana Territory, which includes Missouri, was part of his dream of the empire. And when the revolution took place in Haiti and he was defeated, he needed money to get back on his feet. And the Louisiana Territory was sold to the United States, which made Missouri a part of that, which Missouri was a part of that. And so it's because of Toussaint Louverture.
So the Haitian was responsible for the part of the world, expanding a part of the world that was embracing slavery at the time.
Right.
Right. Back to the phone. Betsy is joining us from St. Louis. Betty, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
John and Sylvia, congratulations on your new book. And my question actually is, how long did it take you to write the book, and what was the basis for the research? How was it done?
Well, Betty,
sounds like a familiar voice.
It sounds like a familiar voice. Sounds like somebody I know. Yeah. The publishers don't give you a lot of time. We had about, about 8 months to do this. And we were fortunate enough to have the assistance of the Mercantile Library, which provided a lot of the pictures we had. And a lot of the information I already had at home. So it boiled down to researching a small group of individuals. And that's pretty much it. And the basis for the book was we started out looking at just St. Louis, and then the publisher wanted us to do the Missouri. And so they pretty well defined the parameters of the book for us.
The publisher, of course, wanted a wider
area for distribution.
Absolutely. We'll have to take another break. My guest is John Wright. He's a retired educator, historian, and author. He has written several books, including this latest, which he did with his wife, Sylvia. It's titled Extraordinary Black Missourians, Pioneers, Leaders, Performers, Athletes, and Other Notables Who Have Made History. We're going to come back and continue the conversation and bring you into it when we do. 382-8255 is the number, or email us at talk@stlpublicradio.org. Back with John Wright in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our conversation with John Wright. He's an educator and historian, and we're talking about his book, Extraordinary Black Missourians, Pioneers, Leaders, Performers, Athletes, and Other Notables Who Have Made History. By the way, I just want to get some of the very familiar names, which I'll just get out of the way. We can talk to them if folks want to, but they get a lot of attention as it is. We all know Dred Scott, Scott Joplin, W.C. Handy, Maya Angelou, Homer Phillips, Dick Gregory, Red Fox, Julius Hunter, old friend Julius is in the book, as is Congressman Bill Clay and Gerald Early, just to name a few. Yeah. Must be fun dealing with the people who are still with us and people you're able to talk to and get information from if you needed it. Yeah. Let's go back to the phones and bring in Bill calling from Hazelwood. Bill, you're on the air with John Wright.
Yeah, Dr. Wright, I'd like to ask you a trivia question to see if you know the answer. First of all, I am white, okay, so it puts me in a somewhat difficult way to describe this guy because I never met him. I have seen him, and I know who he was. But does the name Howardville mean anything to you?
Howardville?
Yeah.
No.
Well, Howardville was a black community in New Madrid County, which is cotton country. I grew up near it. And Dr. Howard is what we called him. He was the founder of Howardville, and he was also a black educator of the segregated school system down in New Madrid County. And he was also, I understand, and I don't know this to be true, was the father of catcher Elston Howard of the New York Yankees.
Sure. Okay, well, that's a good name to know, and maybe you can help me find a photograph of him, and I'll try to do that. I'll call down to New Madrid.
Bill, thanks so much for the call. I think you've given John Wright a head start on volume two of this book. And Sylvia is listening. She's probably making notes as well, right, John?
I think so.
Okay. Let's go back to the phones. We'll bring in Mike, who's calling from North St. Louis.
Yes, good morning.
Hi.
A couple items. When you spoke of entertainers, I think Miles Dewey Davis would be the most, I would say, the greatest entertainer out of this area and so forth. Albums, record sales, or anything and so forth, being innovative in the music and the whole nine yards, whether it's comparing them to Chuck Berry or Clark Terry or whoever it may be. Also, and so forth, the business side. Annie Malone, the African-American female lady who was the first millionaire in the country, whose parade in her name will be coming down Market Street this Sunday, the Annie Malone Parade. She was the first African-American millionaire. And I bring it up to date to 2013. Dave Stewart, the chairman and founder of Worldwide Technology, whose sales, I think, topped $5 billion. So I don't think anyone could compare to the size of that company and the amount of revenue that it generates right here in St. Louis. That's Mr. Dave Stewart. And one last thing. I wouldn't. This is no criticism. But African Americans know just about, you know, we know our history. I'm 63 years old. I mean, if you go by Matthew Dickey or Herbert Hoover or Bryan Cultural Center or Better Family Life, there are volumes and volumes of information and books pertaining to African Americans. So we may not know some of the trivial, you know, some of the names that, you know, that haven't really been publicized outside this area, but we're well versed in so far as our black history. Thank you.
Well, let me say this. We do have Annie Malone and David Stewart. We did not go over to Illinois. I think Illinois is kind of touchy about who claims they're individuals. So we tried to stay on this side of the river, but you're correct. On Annie Malone and David Stewart, they are in the book.
By the way, I was going to bring up Catherine Dunham, and I understand now why she's not in it,
yeah.
Because that's East St. Louis connection,
yes.
Obviously. Let's talk a little bit about Annie Malone. I've been in the Annie Malone Parade, and I bet you have, too. We certainly have attended
it. I used to be in the parade when I was a youngster. You marched the distance according to your age. You know, when I was a Cub Scout, I marched in it, and it was almost like the VP in New Orleans, not the VP in New Orleans, the Mardi Gras parade in New Orleans. It used to come through the community.
Yes.
And people would sit on their porch. It was a time of year when you went from winter clothes to spring clothes. Mm. And it all ended at Annie Malone's children's home. It was a whole day of activity at the playground. You had AAA baseball. You had also you had the drum and bugle corps would practice there on the field. And it was a great day for the community. And I grew up when there was, I guess when it was a hotel for a while before they tore it down. but it was a great place in the community.
And how did she reach her prominence and her financial success?
Well, she started out going door to door. She had three locations before she moved to the Ville area. And she went abroad. She developed the first pressing comb. But it was a door-to-door opportunity. She hired women, and she paid them more than many of the other institutions. Mm-hmm. And so they could make more money from working for Annie Malone.
You know, you mentioned the Ville, and the Ville in and of itself is a story.
Right, that's another story.
I mean, that was where the black community lived, where they could buy homes.
You could go from your elementary school to your professional career without getting on the bus because you had the Lincoln Law School there, you had Poor Old College, you had the School for Handicapped Youngsters, you had Nursing Training Institution, you had the Teacher Training Institution. So it was a whole slew of institutions. You could have gone to school there.
Yeah. Let's go back to the phones. We're getting some calls.
Okay.
And I really like this part of it. A challenge for you, Jim.
Okay,
Wright.
Here goes another one.
Here's Abu. I think I have it pronounced Abu. Go ahead.
Abu, yes, sir. Good morning. How are you all, gentlemen?
Great.
Okay,
how are
you doing?
Good, good. I wanted to mention two individuals who are part of the Islamic history of St. Louis. And probably Mr. Wright won't know this, and you wouldn't either, but St. Louis has been one of the founding cities for Islam in North America. But there was a gentleman by the name of Ibn Yamin. He and a brother by the name of Abdullah Aziz, they were incorporators of the Muslim Brotherhood, the same Muslim Brotherhood that is now in power in Egypt. And they incorporated in St. Louis in 1944. And the man's name originally was Ledbetter. He was he graduated from medical school in Mississippi, but of course in those days they wouldn't allow him to practice. So he came to St. Louis and opened a pharmacy. He was a pharmacist here for many years. But St. Louis has a long Islamic history, and many of the names that the community know them, Brother Munir Ahmed, for example, Brother Saeed. All these people are well-known in the African-American community, and they have made St. Louis one of the friendliest Islamic cities actually in the country. So I thought it'd be important. Of course, Mr. Wright would know about that, but I think it's important that we remember these people and their share in history. So that's all I've got to say.
Let me assure you, he's been writing down the names, and there probably will be another book forthcoming. Thank you for your call.
Actually, there is an exhibit at 4529 Emerson Avenue. It's that new mosque on Highway 70 there. We have a wonderful exhibit that goes back, you know, for example, Art Blakely of the Jazz Messengers.
Sure.
He was a Muslim. Yusuf Lateef, he's still an active Muslim today. Ahmed Jamal, who often comes to the, was it the Bistro, the Bistro, whatever that place
Bistro.
Is. Anyway,
Bistro.
Ahmed Jamal is a member of the French Empire. You know, he's got the Order of France or something. He's a Muslim. And so many of these, Dakota Staten, many of these, some of these names escape me right now, but many of these people are actually Muslims and they have roots in St. Louis. So we just wanted to throw that in, and you all have a nice day.
Same
Thank
here.
You.
Thanks
Thank
for the
you
call.
For sharing.
Well, there is some interesting information.
Yes.
Yeah, all righty. Back to the phones, and Ramsey is calling from St. Louis. Ramsey, thanks for waiting. Go ahead.
Well, good morning, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to throw at Dr. Wright. I'm a graduate of Sumner High School, too, Dr. Wright. But I wanted to throw at you a name, Constance McDonald, who was the first African-American to be hired by Delta Airlines from St. Louis in 1966. And along with her was a young man from Kinloch named Alexander Mitchell. They crossed the picket lines when Dr. King was picketing in Atlanta for Delta. And I was number three.
Okay. And your name?
My name is Ramsey Colibo.
Okay, thank you.
Ramsey?
O-L-I-E, B as in boy, O-I.
Give us that one more time, Ramsey. I think I might have stepped on some of it. The last name?
K as in Kenneth, O-L-I-E, B boy, O-I, Colibo.
Thank you so much for your call, and congratulations on being a part of history.
Thank you very much.
Great to hear from you. Another call, this one from Granite City. It'll be Gary. Go ahead, Gary.
Hi. Just to start things off, I am a white 63-year-old guy. My suggestion is the people that want to find similar information, look up a book called Black Freedom Fighters and Steel. It's by Ruth Needleman, a retired professor from Indiana University. And it's the story how African Americans took on the American steel industry and the United Steelworkers and democratized the union that helped discriminate against African Americans in the workplace. Just a very interesting book, and part of the history that ties into St. Louis was in 1974 because of these people. There was a consent decree in U.S. District Court of Alabama, and the steel workers and the steel industry had to live with that ruling. It just was put to bed about 2 years ago, I think. So anyhow, I just thought your guest would find it very interesting reading.
Well, thank you.
All righty. Thank you, too. Bye-bye.
And labor plays a part in your book. I mean, Roy Wilkins has a is prominent in the book. And he, of course, wore many hats, but as head of the Railroad Porters Union, I guess.
Yeah, Percy Green, who climbed the arch, who had the forced the government to look at union practice and hiring practice.
Right. And you do have a lot of moderns in here, many of whom we've crossed paths over the years. Jet Banks, the late Jet Banks, former state senator. Freeman Bosley Jr., first African-American mayor. Margaret Bush Wilson, always a favorite here. You mentioned Percy Green. Theodore McNeil.
No.
Tell Ted McNeil's story.
Yes, Ted, my aunt, who was active in politics at the time, worked to get him elected to be St. Louis senator from St. Louis. But he was with the Pullman Porters. He got started that way. His daughter, Betty, was principal for Metro. She was at Metro High School.
And, of course, he was president of the St. Louis Police Board for a period
right.
of time.
He was on the board of curators at the University of Missouri.
Yeah.
So he played a vital role in St. Louis.
Yeah. Okay, let's return to our callers. And Zulema, again, I hope I have that pronounced correctly. Zulema, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Go ahead.
And the person that I would nominate is Charles Henry Turner. He was among the first African Americans to receive a PhD in biology. He graduated, got his PhD from the University of Chicago in 1906. And expected to be hired at Tuskegee, but they had just hired George Washington Carver, and they didn't have enough money to hire him. So he ended up in St. Louis at Sumner High School. And, in fact, Turner Middle School is named after Charles Turner. And he was an insect physiologist and behaviorist. He, in 1912, he was selected to the St. Louis Academy of Sciences, which is pretty unheard of at that time for an African-American to get elected to a primarily white Academy of Sciences. He published profusely in leading journals. He represented St. Louis and the St. Louis Academy of Sciences at national and international conferences, and he was also a champion of education inequality for African Americans.
Zulema, I'm looking at his picture right now because it's in John Wright's book. Yeah, that you had to include that one, John.
I had to. Yeah. You know, Charles Turner, he opened the School for Handicapped Youngsters, the first for African Americans in the country, in 1925 was named for Charles Turner. He had to retire because of health, but he chose to stay at Sumner High School. He had many offers all around the country, but he chose to stay here.
Yeah. You know, one of the ones that I found most interesting, again, I'm not a student of history, but I'm not totally ignorant of it either. And I have some familiarity with the Undaunted Courage and the Lewis and Clark Expedition. And I had remembered looking at your book, York, who played such a prominent role in that expedition. Explain who York was.
Well, York was the only African-American.
Right.
On the expedition. And it's interesting, he went out as a scout. He was able to carry a gun. He was able to be an interpreter. He was the Indians trusted him. He was called white black man, you know, because of that. And, you know, black has a magical force among the Indian population. So he's seen sort of as magical. But when he returned home, he received the welcoming like everyone else, but he never got the land. He never got the pay. He was put right back into slavery. But his story is gradually being told all across. There's a statue in Fairhaven, Kentucky. Clark had promised him his freedom. He wrote his brother once, "I had to pay someone to beat him because he had saved my life. I didn't have the courage to do it, so I paid someone to do it because he kept pestering me about his freedom."
But it was Sacagawea who got all the press, if you will.
That's right. She's on the coin,
yeah,
and the money. But he's sort of omitted from the pages of history. And so it's up to us to bring him back. But if you go down to the Drury Hotel across from the courthouse, there's a bronze statue of the whole crew, Lewis and Clark and York. And Sacagawea.
Well, he's getting some due now.
Right.
Yeah. We'll have to take another break. My guest is John Wright, and we are talking about his book, Extraordinary Black Missourians, Pioneers, Leaders, Performers, Athletes, and Other Notables Who Have Made History. We're very interested in taking your calls. We'll come back to those calls when we return. The number is 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can also send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org, or you can also send us a tweet, SDL on air. Back with John Wright in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our conversation with John Wright, author of Extraordinary Black Missourians. That's what we're talking about. And let's get you into the conversation, Karen, calling from St. Louis. Thanks for waiting. Go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call. I was wondering how the author defines unsung heroes. I've noticed, for example, in last Black History Month in February, a local television station ran a series on unsung heroes, but the persons featured were very prominent Black St. Louisans. And how do you attempt to really dig down to finding those who haven't received multiple awards and accolades already?
Well, with the one in this, there's only one individual in this book, and that's Toussaint Louverture. And he should be up there with many of the founders of the city. But he's not recognized in any of our textbooks. And had it not been for him, St. Louis and Missouri would not be a part of the United States, because the Louisiana Territory became a part of the United States because of the Haitian Revolution. So he's a hero in that sense because he's been omitted from our history books.
And that's the definition, unsung, someone who did not get the acclaim or the credit that they would be entitled to.
That's correct.
Yeah.
But I was thinking of local unsung heroes. For example, last year, my much-beloved Frankie Freeman was noted as an unsung hero. Judge Edwards was noted as an unsung hero. But they're not sung. That's the point I'm trying to make. If you're looking within the local community, and how do we go about finding people who are truly unsung? Do we go to social services agencies? Do we go through churches? But my concern is that a lot of people are being missed because we keep revisiting and recycling. And I'll take the rest of the comments off the air. Thank you.
I think it's because their story hadn't been told. I think it's a matter of finding individuals who have done extraordinary things, but their story is waiting to be told. Some individuals get lost in history because their story was never told. And we kind of mentioned that in an introduction to the book. There are some stories that will never be told because we've never heard their stories. And it's a matter of us, those of us who know those individuals, to help get their story out.
It's also a question of people whose stories were out at one time, but they have since been forgotten for one reason or another. And one that comes to mind with regard to your book is Lloyd Gaines, a tragic story, but a very important person for African-American in education in Missouri.
He was the individual who started breaking open the separate but equal doctrine in a series of cases that followed because of him. we force the state to, the court said, either you provide equal educational opportunities or you have to have integrated educational facilities. And rather than do that, they built the Lincoln Law School in St. Louis. But it was a step towards equalizing education for African Americans.
And Lloyd Gaines?
Died before. Well, he disappeared.
We don't know.
Yeah, we went to Chicago, went to the fraternity house. His family, I just spoke with his nephew. They don't know what happened to him. Some think he may have been down in Mexico. We just never know.
He was in Chicago, though, when he disappeared.
He disappeared, went to get some stamps
yeah.
and never returned.
Yeah. Very tragic story. Yeah. I wonder, is it supposed that it might be connected somehow with his rabble-rousing, if you will? Or
it probably could be, you know. Yeah. The Justice Department is opening the case again, you know, after all these years. I don't know what we can find out at this point.
This was 1939, I think.
That's correct.
38. That is a very cold case.
Yeah. Yeah.
Back to the phones. Let's bring in Cassandra calling from St. Louis. Go ahead, Cassandra.
Well, hello. I was calling. I am a pastor actually in Jefferson City. And George Vaughn, I'm not sure if he's in your book because I haven't had a chance to get it, but I will be getting it today if it's out already. He was an attorney in St. Louis, that practiced in St. Louis, probably between the 20s and the 40s, fought a case called Shelley versus Kramer, which led to fair housing rights. There were projects in the city of St. Louis that were named after him, the Vaughn Projects. His daughter was a parishioner of mine in Jefferson City. Her name was Dr. Carolyn Vaughn Atkins. And Dr. Atkins was the first female as well as the first African-American to be the chair of the Board of Probation and Parole of the state of Missouri.
Well,
I thought that they were both noteworthy.
Well, George is in the book in his picture. You'll find it in there, along with the Shelley versus Kramer case.
Excellent.
I wanted to bring up the Shelley versus Kramer case because that is certainly alluded to in your book. We've done programs on that here. And a very, very significant Supreme Court decision basically dealing with the Shelley family and restricted covenants in this community.
Right. It opened up housing, and it had an impact on African-American communities because when housing opened up, it sort of took a lot of the individuals out of the African-American community where they were self-contained, where everyone was forced to live together. Doctors, lawyers, with porters, cooks.
Usually in the Ville.
In the Ville and throughout the area. Mm-hmm. We had black communities all over, but in, I guess you'd say, self-contained. Mm-hmm. But when those areas opened up, it sort of brought down other areas.
But very important case in the late 40s.
1949.
And I bring this up because I think it's significant. This is also something that we address in that St. Louis history in black and white, by the way, is the fact that there were a lot of white people that were also involved in that case and very, very helpful to that case. And I think it's important to note that it wasn't always black versus white, that there was a lot of cooperation in many cases.
You know, in our book, we've tried to point out the fact that you had whites also who were helpful to blacks. Yeah. If you look at Archer Alexander, it was William Elliott, the Chancellor of Washington University, who saved him from slavery and who played an important role in his life. And there are others, countless others throughout. Eleanor Roosevelt with Charles Alexander, who made the Tuskegee Airmen possible. So in the book, we do point out working together, black and whites have made a difference.
And there was the Oldham family here in St. Louis. He and his
Charles,
wife, Charles. Were very big. But I have a name here, too, that I found in your book that caught my eye. Hiram Young, a businessman, very successful. But he held slaves.
He held slaves like John Barry Meacham. He gave them skills. They paid him back. He set them free. And I think that was a difference. You know, I'll purchase your freedom. You work for me, pay me back, you leave me with a skill, and you go out on your own.
Another thing that I found most interesting in your book was the fact that there are any number of people who are included who did purchase their own freedom. And I think that's not something that is generally recognized as something that happened with some frequency.
Right. St. Louis in particular, they didn't have a need for slaves. Many of them had inherited slaves. And so they let individuals hire themselves out. And when you hire yourself out, you pay me so much, you collect so much, save so much, and you're free. You purchase your own freedom. And so we had a number of that.
Back to the phones. Let's call on Clifton, or he's calling on us. Clifton, go ahead. You're on the air.
Well, thank you very much for taking my call. I just wanted to commend you on the book, and I wanted to ask you, I have a friend who is writing a book as we speak that covers the 157-year period prior to 1865, and it's a tribute to almost 12 million what we might call unsung heroes and their contribution as a group to the meteoric rise of the United States as a world power because of their unpaid labor and the extent to which they are at the center of almost every constitutional decision and economic decision that the nation made from colonialism to its founding. And we were just speaking yesterday and hearing your name, I was just wondering if I might get contact information from you so that we can speak with you possibly about how to go about finding a publisher and getting this story out. Thank you very much.
Before you go, Clifton, I'm not sure how we want to work this, but why don't you leave a contact number with the screener on the phone, and John can contact you. John, do you want to give a number, John? Do you want to?
Was going to say the publisher, Reedy Press, is very much open to these types of books, and I would say Reedy Press, you could contact them, and also you can contact me, and you can leave a number. But I can get that information to you.
Okay, Clifton? We may have lost him. Well, he can call back, and we can get him some sort of contact information if he doesn't choose to go to Reedy. Let's go to University City this time and bring in Tom. Go ahead, Tom.
Hi. First of all, I'm a Caucasian man, and I just want to thank you. I think this program is wonderful today.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask Dr. Wright if Catherine Nelson is in his book.
No, Catherine is not in the book.
Are you familiar with Catherine?
I know of Catherine. She used to be over the nursery school. And she was the Danforth Foundation, but she's not there. We had a hard time narrowing down the number of people we could put in from St. Louis because this is a statewide book, and so picking and choosing, as you know, can be a difficult task.
I understand. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for the call. I have a name for you because we've talked to his daughter a number of times here. His name is David Grant. Do you know David Grant?
I do know David.
Yeah. The late David Grant, I should say, but he was a formidable fixture in this community. For many years, he was the parliamentarian at the Board of Aldermen, among other things, a very renowned lawyer.
It's thanks to David Warsh you integrated the school because they were not paying taxes, and out-of-state students were receiving the benefits of St. Louis taxpayers. So Dave, as a friend of the court with the NAACP, said if you don't admit African Americans, you have to start paying taxes. And like many things, a money issue. When it came to money, a decision was made to integrate the school.
He also is very helpful to Josephine Baker when she came to town because she couldn't stay in any of the hotels. So that was commonplace in those days. So David put her up with a family. He's friends with Cab Calloway. He's an interesting story. That's the point I want to make. Let's bring in Gary calling from St. Louis. Gary, thanks for being with us. Go ahead.
Yes, I was just wondering if Dr. Howard Philip Venable is in your book, Dr. Wright. Are you familiar with him?
Yes, I am. Homer G. Phillips. If I'm not mistaken, I think he did open heart surgery. Many people don't know about that.
Not quite. You're in the right arena, but he was a pioneer in ophthalmology. And the reason I was asking about him, back in those years, back in the 50s and 60s, training was not available. So he allowed for Afro-American and other minorities to be trained. And by doing that, he spread the knowledge and the care for eye surgery throughout metropolitan St. Louis and throughout the nation, out of St. Louis. This is all coming out of St. Louis. To this date, even though he's deceased, there are national and international lectures given in his name and awards still given in his name. And this is a St. Louisan who trained hundreds of ophthalmologists that are still in practice throughout the nation. So I didn't know if he was in your book or not.
No, he's not.
Yeah.
Not, well worth considering, though.
Not this one.
Okay.
We'll see. Stay tuned. A couple of names I wanted to bring up because they're familiar to most of us, but we may not know why. He mentioned Homer Phillips. Of course, Homer Phillips Hospital. Who was Homer Phillips?
Homer G. Phillips was an attorney who had worked with the city in passing the bond issue with the understanding that a portion of the money would be set aside for a hospital for African Americans. The city wanted to renege on that promise, made all kind of offers, but he persisted. And he died before the hospital was built. He was assassinated one morning on the way to work. He was down the corner of Albert and Euclid and Delmar, Albert and Delmar, and he was shot down. And that's an unsung mystery.
Yeah.
I mean, unsolved mystery, unsung. Not unsung, but unsolved mystery to this date.
Kind of reminiscent of the Lloyd Gaines story, is it not? Another one, we're all familiar, or many of us, with the Julia Davis Library in St. Louis. But who was Julia Davis?
Julia Davis was a teacher who taught for over 40 years in the St. Louis public schools, a strong proponent of integrated education. At her retirement, she gave, I think, $1,200 to the St. Louis Public Library with the understanding it would be used to purchase books for on African-American individuals. She had a large collection of her own she donated to the library, and her library was dedicated in her honor on Natural Bridge near Newstead. Mm-hmm. The only person they'd done that for a living person, she was alive at the time.
Right. Julia Davis, again, that's one of those names that people know but don't know quite why.
Right.
About another one, as time begins to slip away, John Wright, and that is Frankie Baker. I think most of us of a certain age are familiar with the Frankie and Johnny story, but this is the Frankie.
Yeah, there were four folklores that came out of St. Louis. Frankie and Johnny was one of those. Frankie Baker, it started out Frankie and Albert. That was the original song. And the mother got very disturbed over that, so they changed it to Frankie and Johnny. But Frankie Baker was a lady of the evening who was taking care of Johnny and Albert at the time. And they got in a quarrel, and she ended up shooting him. He pulled a knife, and she shot him. And it was a time we didn't have air conditioning, so bartenders would make up songs on the day's news, and that ended up being one of the big news stories of the day. In the local bar, it went viral, as you can say, all over the country. She died in a mental institution in Portland, Oregon.
I think that that particular story has been filmed many times as part of movies. I can remember Sid Charisse and I think Gene Kelly dancing to Frankie and Johnny. At
Mae West had a movie also, yeah.
Okay. Well, that predates even me a little bit, John. Right. Just a few seconds left. Is there a favorite? What is your favorite of all the people that you address in this book? Who is your favorite?
Why would you ask me that?
Because there's you have 30 seconds left.
There are so many individuals. You know, I can't. Callie House, I think, who for slave reparation, she was trying to get something for people who were in slavery in their late lives so they could be buried. And she went to jail for trying to help. And that was something it's a real sad story.
Bottom line may be that they're all favorites because they all play such an important role in so many different ways.
Yeah, it's hard to make that decision. It's hard.
John Wright, thank you for being with us. The book, once again, is Extraordinary Black Missourians, Pioneers, Leaders, Performers, Athletes, and Other Notables Who Have Made History. Enjoyed seeing you again. Thank you.
And I thank you for having me.
Join Steve Potter tomorrow for Cityscape when he'll talk about the St. Louis Blues Week Festival, Max and Louis Productions staging of Jeffrey Hatcher's Mrs. Manerly, and with vocalist Brian Owens and Aaron Bodie, and pianist Peter Martin about their concert to benefit Kids Rock's cancer program. Monday on St. Louis on the Air, we'll take a look at what was and wasn't accomplished during the current session of the Missouri Legislature. It ends tomorrow. Archived versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is produced by Mary Edwards and Alex Hoyer, with production assistance from Aaron Dorr, Greg Buntino, Spencer Reed, and Hannah Durham. The executive producer is Robert Peterson. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.